Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is January the 8th, 2020, and season's greeting to all. A shout out to all the military men and women serving our country. We thank them for their services. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone, each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Feature segments this evening: Benjamin Rockwell with part two of Windows 7 End of Life. From the Tech Corner, AT&T is not a good corporate citizen. And Marty Winston peeks into his tech product crystal ball. But first, the tech news of the week. Cable TV a la carte is on hold. Watch all your favorite channels without having to pay for the dozens you never view. Maine is trying to become the first state in the country to require cable providers to offer programming a la carte, with a law enacted early last year that gives customers alternatives to the bundles of channels offered by most providers. The effort opens a new front in a long-running debate in the telecommunications industry. It comes as the industry is already undergoing change. Millions of consumers are abandoning traditional cable in favor of lower-cost streaming services. Disney and nearly every other major entertainment company are spending billions on new content and services that are massively expanding viewing choices. Last March, Maine passed a law requiring cable operators to offer channels on an a la carte basis, and Maine's law has been challenged. Comcast and several cable programmers sued, alleging that federal law preempts Maine's efforts. Comcast was joined by Disney, Fox Cable, NBC Universal, and they filed a temporary restraining order to delay the law. District Judge Nancy Torreson delivered her ruling after hearing arguments. The court backs Comcast, puts Maine a la carte cable law on hold. Judge Torreson ruled that the three arguments filed by the cable operators, two of the three arguments probably won't fly, but the third just might. Comcast spearheaded the coalition of companies which filed a suit in September. The Maine law, the first of its kind in the nation, was invalid for two reasons. The suit argued, first, because it preempts federal communications law, and second, because it violates companies' First Amendment rights. Comcast was joined by more than a dozen other plaintiffs, including its own NBC Universal subsidiary, CBS, Viacom, which has not yet completed its merger with CBS, Disney, Fox, ANA, Discovery, and Hearst. As is common in such suits, the plaintiffs first sought an injunction that would block the state from enforcing the law while the rest of the legal process gets sorted out. District Judge Nancy Torreson granted the injunction in a ruling issued just before Christmas. In her ruling, there was one good argument and two bad ones. The injunction would only be granted if the plaintiff had a chance of winning on the merits of an argument. Torreson explained in her ruling that two of the main arguments Comcast put forth were unlikely to prevail. She found the third, it might. The preemption argument was likely a bust. Torreson ruled that because Maine's law, as written, is content neutral, LD 832 requires cable operators to offer access to cable channels and programs individually. She noted, but it does not require or prohibit cable operators from carrying any particular channel or program. The First Amendment argument, meanwhile, was broken down into two separate parts. The companies first argue that they have an innate right to bundle, as bundling cable channels together is, from their point of view, editorial discretion of the same sort a newspaper editor shows in bundling sections together. This argument doesn't fly. Torreson found in part because the plaintiffs do not explain why cable operators' editorial discretion to choose what channels or programs to offer, which is protected by the First Amendment, should extend to cable operators' discretion in how to sell that programming. Nor does the main bill prohibit bundling. She pointed out it only mandates that unbundled options also be made available. The companies did succeed, though, with their other First Amendment-based argument. In short, they made the case that the main law violated their rights because it applied narrowly to traditional cable carriers, but not to alternative internet-based platforms, such as Dish, Sling, Sony, View, or YouTube TV, that also provided bundled content. Torreson granted the preliminary injunction on those First Amendment grounds. She said the following: although I had anticipated consolidating the preliminary injunction hearing with a trial on the merits, she concluded that the evidentiary record is not sufficiently developed to make a final determination, and so there will be further hearings in early 2020. So we'll stay tuned, and hopefully, from a consumer point of view, a la carte channel offering has not been totally killed. Tax prep companies can't hide their free filing software from Google anymore. The IRS is now also free to make a competitor to TurboTax. About 70% of American taxpayers are eligible for free file, according to the IRS. But there are some restrictions. The eligibility requirements vary from year to year, and you may not qualify every year. As of 2018, you must have had an adjusted gross income, that's the AGI, of $66,000 or less to use free file software. By the way, if you want the list of free file software, you can obtain from the following website. The website that lists the major tax software free filing services is tax-software.bestreviews.net/free-versions. I'll repeat that a little later. Previously, the IRS and the industry memorandum of understanding said that in recognition of this commitment to offer free filing services to low-income taxpayers, the federal government has pledged to not enter the tax return software and e-file services marketplace. The new addendum says that sentence has hereby stricken from the agreement. An original objective of the free file program was to encourage private industry investment in technology and services to deliver on IRS goals of increasing e-filing. With approximately 90% of taxpayers e-filing today, the language is no longer relevant and is not a prerequisite for Intuit's continued participation in the free file program. Critics of the program came to believe that this language was the only thing stopping the IRS from offering tax preparation software and assistance, and that companies participated in free file only in exchange for this promise. That is wrong, and we should be removing that language that fostered this confusion. The addendum released by the IRS also states that tax prep companies are prohibited from engaging in any practice that would cause the members' free file landing page to be excluded from an organic internet search. The deletion of the IRS promise not to compete against the industry raises the possibility of the IRS offering its own free tax filing service. The IRS hasn't announced any plans to do that, but the change could put more pressure on software makers to live up to the full terms of their deal with the government. Well, what brought all this about? Tax prep companies were hiding their free filing software from Google search. Intuit and other tax filing software makers lobbied for legislation that would have prohibited the Internal Revenue Service from offering a free online tax filing option. The House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee approved such a ban in April 2019, but lawmakers later dropped that proposal. The Internal Revenue Service announced changes that will hopefully make it less stressful for a lot of Americans to file their taxes in 2020. In an addendum to the almost 20-year-old free file agreement, the agency has put new protections in place to make it easier for Americans to file their taxes for free. Moving forward, the addendum prohibits TurboTax maker Intuit and the other 9 companies that make up the Free File Alliance from engaging in any practice that would prevent their free software from showing up on Google or any other search engine. Additionally, all 10 companies must now stick to a standardized naming scheme so that you can easily identify their free software. The next time you search for one of their apps, it should be called IRS Free File Program delivered by, and then the name of the company itself. Actually, all you really need is say free plus file plus and the product name itself. However, the most significant change is that IRS is now free to create its own software. Under the previous version of the deal, the agency had agreed not to compete with the industry under the understanding those companies would offer free software for low and middle income Americans to use come tax season. The addendum comes after relentless reporting from ProPublica in April, in which they issued a report that showed Intuit and H&R Block had included code in their free software that prevented the apps from showing up on Google. Intuit also spent years lobbying the government to prevent the IRS from changing the free file agreement. Intuit said it strongly supports these changes to the free file program and associated free file offering because they increase the focus on the taxpayer experience. "We applaud," they said, "the IRS and the Free File Alliance who work together to bring about these important reforms." Intuit currently faces several lawsuits for its past behavior. The website that lists the major tax software free filing services is tax-software.bestreviews.net/free-versions. Score one for the public. As I have said before, the Internet of Things is not ready for prime time. An example of this is that Google cuts Xiaomi net access for showing photos of strangers' homes. Google has disabled access of Xiaomi's devices after a user said he was able to see into the homes of strangers while trying to stream video to his Google Nest Hub. The problem here is that there are no interface standards that have been accepted by everyone. And that's why I keep saying the Internet of Things, all the devices are there to be interconnected, but it's not ready for prime time. Google said the following: "We're aware of the issue and are in contact with Xiaomi to work on a fix." Google said in a statement on Friday that in the meantime, we're disabling Xiaomi's integrations on our devices. The move comes 2 days after a Xiaomi camera owner in the Netherlands said he saw still images of homes that aren't his own as he tried to stream video from the smart device to Google's Nest Hub. The images included a baby fast asleep in a crib, an old man dozing off in an armchair in a sun-filled living room. The incident was first reported by Android police. Upon investigation, they said that they have found out that the issue was caused by a cache update on December the 26th, 2019, which was designed to improve camera streaming quality. It said that the incident that the user experienced happened during the integration between the Mi Home Security Camera Basic 1080p, the model the Dutch user owns, and the Google Home Hub with a display screen under poor network conditions. It has suspended the integration service until the root cause is solved. According to Xiaomi, the issue would not occur if the camera is linked to Xiaomi's own Mi Home app. Home security cameras have long had security issues. Last week, Wyze Labs, that's W-Y-Z-E, which makes smart cameras and connected home gadgets, confirmed database holding millions of customer information were exposed to the public. The leaked data included customer email addresses, as well as the email addresses of those people who were given permission to view the camera feeds. a list of cameras in customers' home and tokens used to connect to smartphones and personal assistants were left open for public view. The Internet of Things is not ready for prime time. ATSC 3.0 over-the-air tuners will be released in the United States in the next few days. The Advanced Television Systems Committee, ATSC, announced that the International Telecommunications Union has adopted ATSC 3.0 as a recommended digital broadcast standard in a press release. The ATSC explained that the ATSC 3.0 standard offers more flexibility and adaptability for broadcasters, resulting in an improved viewing experience for consumers on both home and mobile screens. A U.S. consortium known as AWARN, that's AWARN, has advocated for the use of ATSC 3.0 features, including data casting and automatically waking up devices in order to provide an emergency alert system with support for embedded rich media and finer geo-targeting. With initial U.S. deployments in place, the first announcements of consumer receivers for the United States market will shortly be made available. You may be asking, what will this do for me? ATSC 3.0 is the world's first broadcast standard built on an Internet protocol backbone. This offers the advantage of both broadcast and broadband, designed to integrate with Internet-delivered content. ATSC 3.0 will present viewers with more streams, more choices, more channels, and more flexibility. The next step, according to the ATSC, is to update the guidelines for best practices in implementing ATSC 3.0 and providing support for new devices and technology, with new consumer receivers just days away from becoming available in the United States market. Those plans are already underway. The system is currently commercially deployed in South Korea, where audiences have been enjoying high-quality Ultra HD video and next-generation audio from ATSC 3.0 broadcasts since 2017. U.S. commercial deployment begins in earnest this year. ATSC 3.0 is the world's first broadcast standard built on an Internet protocol backbone. This offers the advantage of both broadcast and broadband, designed to integrate with Internet-delivered content. ATSC 3.0 will present viewers with more streams, more choices, more channels, and more flexibility. Unlike the current standard, ATSC 3.0 makes use of both over-the-air signals and in-your-home broadband to deliver an experience closer to cable or satellite, meaning you should be able to receive more channels in higher quality without the need for a large antenna. ATSC 3.0 combines over-the-air broadcast signals with your home internet. Okay, now what? ATSC 3.0 is based on OFMD and tends to have better performance in dynamic and high-level static multipath situations and offers advantages for single-frequency networks and mobile reception. ATSC 3.0 will provide more robust reception. ATSC 3.0 will provide more robust reception over the air. If you follow cord cutting closely, you may have heard about a new broadcast standard called ATSC 3.0, promising to deliver ultra-high definition, that's UHD TV, anywhere, anytime. ATSC 3.0 is an Internet Protocol IP-based over-the-air TV broadcast system that combines broadcasting and broadband internet. Anyone who pays for cable television knows that the low rates that big cable companies advertise aren't the rates you end up paying over the long haul. Cable TV bills commonly get inflated when it comes to the myriad of fees that are tacked on your billing statement. Now there's new legislation, and has made it past the House and Senate and has been signed by the President. And this new bill was lobbied by Consumer Reports, that's called the Television Viewer Protection Act 2019. The act was stuffed inside an appropriation bill, but the cable TV industry was aware and was able to post some last-minute shenanigans and have a key provision in the bill changed. In the initial version of the legislation, there was a provision of truth in advertising, so big cable operators had to advertise with the entire fee schedule. That is no longer a component of the bill. However, essentially, the latest version of this bill doesn't speak to advertising, but bans the cable companies from charging you extra rent for hardware you own. Some cable companies, such as Frontier, is specifically called out, were charging users fees for bringing customers' own modems to the service. The bill also forced cable providers to send new subscribers an itemized list of any fees and surcharges that will be added to accounts within 24 hours of the user signing up for the service. The bill also forces cable providers to send new subscribers an itemized list of any fees and surcharges that will be added to accounts within 24 hours of the user signing up for the service. The bill also has a provision to allow users to get out of the service without penalty if the fees are too high. The bill is a good start, but won't fix all the issues with the cable industry. It also mostly applies to cable companies, not broadband providers. Revenues for cable companies are on the decline as more and more customers cut the cord and go streaming only. In September, AT&T was exploring the sale of DirecTV as the satellite service was underperforming. The TRACE Act, which stands for Telephone Robocall Abuse Criminal Enforcement and Deterrence Act, was sponsored by Senators John Thune of South Dakota, Ed Markey of Massachusetts, and Roger Wicker from Mississippi. Its purpose is to combat robocalls with stronger deterrence. As the volume of illegal calls has increased, so has the attention of regulators. It is now officially law. It's supposed to combat robocalls with stronger deterrence. As the volume of legal calls has increased, so has the attention of regulators. This legislation will update our laws and regulations to stiffen penalties, increase transparency, and enhance government collaboration to stop unwanted solicitation. The move comes as part of a crackdown against the targeting companies and individuals who have collectively placed more than 1 billion unwanted calls for financial schemes and other services. This bill, which passed in the Senate in May and the House earlier this month, came following the Federal Communications Commission's announcement of a nationwide crackdown on illegal robocalls in June. The legislation imposes stiffer fines of as much as $10,000 per call on robocallers who knowingly flout the laws on calls and instructs the FCC further regulations that could shield consumers from unwanted calls. It will also accelerate the rollout of so-called call authentication technologies the industry is currently developing, which could cut down on the number of calls coming from unverified numbers. The law isn't the only measure being taken to target the calls. The FCC voted in June to give wireless carriers like Verizon the green light to block unwanted robocalls automatically for all customers. In August, 12 of the nation's largest telecommunications companies and attorneys generals from all 50 states plus Washington, D.C., announced a voluntary agreement to prevent and punish illegal robocallers. Telemarketers allege the Do Not Call list violated their First Amendment rights. In 2003, the Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communications Commission passed rules authorizing the creation of such a registry to protect consumer privacy and to prohibit abusive telemarketing practices. Commercial telemarketers generally are prohibited from calling any phone numbers on the Do Not Call list. Are telemarketing calls speech protected by the First Amendment? Does the federal no-call registry violate the First Amendment? Federal district judge in Colorado applied the Central Hudson test. Truthful advertising and advertising for legal products and services is protected. Telemarketers have challenged many of these regulations as violations of their First Amendment rights to free speech. However, because telemarketing is a form of commercial speech, the courts have granted it less protection than to other forms of speech and have generally upheld the restrictions. There are exceptions, and I call them legal loopholes. Placing one's number on the National Do Not Call Registry will stop some, but not all, unsolicited calls. The following are exceptions granted by existing laws and regulations, and these types of organizations can register with donotcall.gov and can purchase telephone lists from the Do Not Call Registry. You mean they can get phone numbers from the Do Not Call Registry and use them? Yep, that's what it means. The registry only applies to personal calls, not to business lines or business-to-business calls. A person may still receive calls from, you guessed it, political organizations. The organization Citizens for Civil Discourse has lobbied Congress to close this exception by developing a national political Do Not Call Registry where voters can register their phone numbers and ask politicians to take the Do Not Contact pledge. Its database is not backed by the force of law. Only three politicians running for office signed the pledge. A person may still receive calls from not-for-profit organizations. A person may still receive calls from those conducting surveys. A person may still receive calls from company up to 31 days after submitting an application or inquiry unless the company is specifically asked not to call. A person may still receive calls from bill collectors. These callers are, however, regulated by other laws, such as the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which limits them to calling during reasonable hours. Some creditors may not call debtors who file for bankruptcy protection. According to the 2009 economic report of the president, prepared by the Council of Economic Advisers, they said the program has proved quite popular. As of 2007, according to one survey, 72% of Americans had registered on the list, and 77% of those say that it made a large difference in the number of telemarketing calls that they receive. Another 14% report a small reduction in calls. Another survey conducted less than a year after the Do Not Call list was implemented found that people who registered for the list saw a reduction in telemarketing calls from an average of 30 calls per month to an average of 6 per month. Heck, I get 5 a day. And the loophole there is that nonprofits, people taking survey, and politicians can access the list of phone numbers. So, on the one hand, a Do Not Call registry is made up, and people can access the phone numbers on that list for their use. As the number of phone numbers on the National Do Not Call Registry surpassed 139 million, the Federal Trade Commission reiterated that despite the claims made in emails circulating on the Internet, consumers should not be concerned that their cell phone numbers will be released to telemarketers at any time in the near future. Well, how do they know a phone number is a cell number? Because it used to be just 917. Today, because you can use your home number and transfer it to a cell phone, how would you know it's not a cell phone number or it is a cell phone number? In addition, according to the agency, it is not necessary to register cell phone numbers on the Do Not Call Registry to be protected from most marketing calls to cell phones. The truth about cell phones and the Do Not Call Registry is as follows. Contrary to the email, cell phone numbers are not being released to telemarketers, and you will not soon be getting telemarketing calls on your cell phone. Heck, I don't know about that. I've been getting spam calls and robocalls on my cell phone. There is no deadline by which you must register your cell phone number on the registry. Federal Communications Commission regulations prohibit telemarketers from using automated dialers to call cell phone numbers. Automated dialers are standard for the industry, so most telemarketers are barred from calling consumers on their cell phones without their consent. The National Association representing telemarketers have stated that their clients do not intend to start calling consumers' cell phones. There is only one DNC registry. There is no separate registry for cell phones. The DNC registry accepts registrations from both cell phones and landlines. You must call from the phone number that you want to register. If you register online, you must respond to a confirmation email. While the telecommunication industry has been discussing the possibility of creating a wireless 411 directory, according to the FCC, even if a wireless 411 directory is established, most telemarketing calls to cell phones would still be illegal, regardless of whether the numbers listed on the federal government or national do not call registry. Well, a law is needed, and at least this is a tiny step towards that end. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with Part 2 of Windows 7 End of Life. Part 1 was aired last week and is available on podcast.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, your nerdy IT professional. And this is where we get into the business aspects. This is where I give you some tidbits from my current and past experience of being in the IT field for 30 years. Now, last week we talked about the Windows 7 to Windows 10 migration, a Windows 7 end of life issue. Now, I did receive some questions. One of them is, how big is this issue? Let's talk about this from the perspective of how many systems are on Windows 7 and how many are on Windows 10. Now, a year ago, it was actually kind of scary. There were 44.7% of the people out there on Windows 7. 43.8% were on Windows 10. So we had not even arrived at the point where we had more people on Windows 10, the new operating system, than we did on Windows 7, the 8-year-old at that point operating system. Now, we have made some inroads in this, and this is throughout the Windows ecosphere. This is throughout all of the different systems, not only business, but home. Windows 10 is now on 61.9%. Windows 7 still on 31.2%. That's almost a third of the systems out there are still running this 9-year-old, today, 9-year-old operating system. It's somewhat worse than what we had experienced when we arrived at the Windows XP end of life. Back then, it was a little bit more. It was somewhere around 35% at end of life, on the drop-dead end of life date. I think it was somewhere around 35%. We're a little bit ahead of the curve, but it's still quite a distance to go. Now, what is the fastest way for anybody to fix this? All right, so I'm going to address this both from the business perspective, but also the personal perspective. The fastest way, if you've got a system that is under 5 years old, I'm going to tell you right now, the best way to do this is to just go through, you go, you get Windows 10, you install Windows 10. It is a long, arduous install. It takes, I think, the last time I did it on a normal hard drive system, not anything that's going to be like an SSD drive or anything like this. On a normal hard drive, I think it was about 2 hours. When we count in everything, including all of the patching. Now, what if you've got an older system? What if you have a system that is, 9 years old, 5 years old? I have this personal rule in regards to replacing hardware. At a 5-year point, Moore's Law. What is Moore's Law? That says that all of your hardware, and initially it was a matter of we just thought of this as CPU power, but this is extended to hard drives. This is extended to monitors in some form. There's a number of different things in regards to how many transistors you can get into a square inch. And Moore's Law says that you can do this, and in 18 months it will double. And yes, we do have some variance in there, but it also, this is all for the same amount of money too. So we find that, what you have 5 years ago, that is worth, a fraction of what you paid for it. Today's systems are going to be far more powerful. We're talking, somewhere around 6 to 8 times more powerful. They're going to be a little bit cheaper. they're going to be 6 to 8 times faster, 6 to 8 times more memory, more you name it. It all just translates really well. If you are working on a system that is old and slow and clunky, it might not even run Windows 10. There are some requirements that you have in order to go to Windows 10. For instance, you have to have a gigahertz or faster processor. Okay, that's an easy one. The gigahertz speed was passed a long time ago. You do need a gigabyte of RAM. That was also passed a long time ago. We passed those benchmarks ages ago. Hard drive space, 16 gigs. Again, a long time ago. Even the display resolution, 800 by 600. But these, everything I've just said, are minimum specifications to run Windows 10. These are the bare bones. Some companies are going through, they are pre-installing Windows 10 and the various required software packages onto a hard drive. And then they're running something called Ghost. Ghost does a nice, perfect image of that hard drive, and they can put that image onto 100 hard drives. They then run a program called Sysprep. Actually, it's the other way around. They run the Sysprep, and then they copy it. But that allows them to drop that hard drive into a system very readily, and then it just pops up. It runs Windows 10. In a matter of 10, 15 minutes, we can spend, IT professionals, we can spend somewhere around $25, $30 on a hard drive, have it preloaded with the Windows 10, of course, and all of the different things you're going to need in the office. And then we just go around to your systems and we just plug this hard drive in. Now, it sounds great, but you're going to lose all of your data. You're going to lose access to everything that you had already set up. Every configuration, every little different thing that set up your computer just the way you want it. My best suggestion for you, back up your system. Find out how they can back up your system, how they can back up all of your preferences, all of your different files that you've saved locally, everything. Make sure whenever anybody does an upgrade that you get everything that you had before. So Windows 10, is it something to worry about? I said last week, and I'm going to still hold to this. No, relax. It's all going to be fine. We're going to get it taken care of. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. AT&T sticks it to American tech workers, forcing them to train foreign replacements. AT&T is reportedly laying off thousands of American workers after forcing them to train their foreign replacements who have been imported through the H-1B visa program. AT&T enriches itself on public spectrum, and yet they're going after American tech workers by forcing them to train their H-1B replacement. This is unacceptable. The H-1B program is completely broken and must be changed or disbanded, as it is not addressing shortages in the job market. It is supplanting qualified Americans. It is particularly ironic that AT&T is engaged in this blatant abuse of American workers while they are dependent on publicly owned spectrum in order to build their 5G network. If any company should be a good corporate citizen, it is AT&T. The FCC should investigate whether AT&T is meeting their responsibilities under the recent AT&T Time Warner merger and should be blocked from additional spectrum purchases based on the egregious abuse of immigration laws. Every year, more than 100,000 foreign workers are brought to the United States on the H-1B visa. There are about 650,000 H-1B visa foreign workers in the United States at any given moment. Americans are often laid off in the process and forced to train their foreign replacements. More than 85,000 Americans annually potentially lose their jobs to foreign labor through the H-1B visa program. Despite claims by the big business lobby, American workers who have been replaced by H-1B foreign workers say there is no shortage of talented and qualified citizens for high-paying white-collar jobs. Current and former AT&T employees said that they are being laid off after being forced to train their H-1B foreign replacements. Many have worked for the company for over a decade. They aren't being offered severance or early retirement and may not easily find a comparable job elsewhere with similar pay. AT&T spokesperson Jim Kimberly said that employees are being helped to find other jobs inside the company. "We are continuously working to be more efficient in our operations," Kimberly said. "To the extent possible, we're managing this staff adjustment through attrition and are helping employees find other positions within the company." Last year, U.S. businesses and corporations attempted to outsource nearly 420,000 American jobs to foreigners through the H-1B visa program. More than 2.7 million H-1B foreign workers have been approved to come to the United States to take American jobs between 2007 and 2017 in that 10-year period. During that same period, businesses tried to outsource almost 3.5 million American jobs to foreign workers instead of hiring Americans. "No, the problem is that we give H-1B visas to outsourcing companies. These companies don't need government assistance. It is insane to give them such assistance. Specifically, that assistance is the ability to bypass the American free labor market in favor of an external market where the workers are willing to work for less. We can't really stop outsourcing. The model is simple. Move jobs to where the labor is cheaper. Because the dollar is so valued, people work on minimum wage in the United States, pay more in taxes than the average overseas worker. Again, it is impossible to stop outsourcing. The issue is, should our government be rolling out the red carpet, give every break to such companies? No way should that happen. The U.S. government should give no market-manipulating help to such companies. The companies should use the U.S. free labor market exclusively, since they don't benefit the U.S. economy. Outsourcing may benefit companies, and hey, I believe in capitalism, so that's actually okay. The H-1B program is not capitalism. It is a federal government program that manipulates the free market, essentially picking the winners and the losers. It is fundamentally anti-capitalist, since they are corporate welfare that benefits companies with the resources to pursue them. We should encourage healthy free market competition for labor and not allow lobbyists and campaign donors to write our immigration laws. That's one man's opinion. Presenting Marty Winston as he shared a peek into his tech product crystal ball.
Last week, I promised to give you my forecast for the new year, and then I changed the subject, not to avoid it, but to get those other discussions done, like CES. No sense talking about it after the fact when you can talk about it before. And when it comes to talking about what's coming in the next year, it's kind of nice to be doing it during CES. So what qualifies me to predict the future? Well, nothing. It's all at least a little inaccurate, and in that way, it also resembles history. But let me give you an example of how I think about things coming together with other things into a somewhat different thing that can help change things. Video cameras for surveillance have been getting a lot more sophisticated and a lot less expensive at a dramatic pace over the past few years. We've also seen some major improvements in fairly small but sustainable solar power sources thanks to improvements in solar cells and batteries and the power efficiency of their connecting electronics. Put those together, and before the end of 2020, I think we'll be seeing some outdoor-optimized, completely wireless video surveillance cameras that can stream their video 24/7 without wires, at least not at the camera end. Now that we've seen that self-driving cars aren't always the world's best drivers, I think we'll see some new car accessories. They might look like radar detectors, new things that warn us when self-driving cars or trucks are nearby, probably by detecting their LiDAR lasers. There's one specific kind of robotics that I'd like to annihilate: robocalls. And there's an attribute of those that I think the phone companies will seize. Have you noticed how many of them come from invalid phone numbers? If you see the number on caller ID and try calling back, which I don't recommend you do because some of those are nasty, costly traps, you'll hear the message that says something like,
The number that you called is not a working number.
Well, if the phone company has a way of knowing and telling you that it's not a working number, then they could use that information as a way to stop those calls from ever ringing your phone in the first place. And there's some new moves from government to kind of compel them to do that without charging us for it. I'm loving that. Let's kill those robocalls. Smart doorbells with the built-in cameras and microphones and speakers and all that are proving pretty stupid because the bad guys can recognize them before getting even close. Sometimes they just pop the box and pull the batteries or use a piece of black tape or some spray paint. So I'm crossing my fingers in hopes of new smart doorbells that don't look like they are. The best home automation devices, and I've said this many times before, are invisible. There are other, better places to hide cameras in view of your front door area. Or, you know, come up with a smart doorbell that isn't any bigger than a doorbell button and looks like one. Electric cars are driving new waves of research into the science and technology of batteries. And I think some of that will show up in smaller batteries offering more power over a wider range of temperatures. I'd like to see that in power tools, among other places. Does your car have a car radio? I'm afraid there isn't much future for those. Reality will turn the car's central dashboard into an extension of the driver's smartphone. Listening to the radio can still happen by streaming a favorite station, but other content can also stream. Like, how about, wouldn't you love to have a self-generating daily mix of news or sports or humor or music, plus hyperlocal traffic alerts and weather alerts, pop-up real-time maps suggesting alternate routes, that kind of thing. By putting the content nexus, the focal point for the content, in the phone instead of in the car, that chunk of dashboard may avoid turning obsolete. The other question that, you know, all this raises is, how will broadcast radio stations respond? My guess is they'll be how your car delivers a lot of that personally tailored daily mix of news, info, and music. Or maybe not. Maybe they'll just fold. I am very encouraged. I'll do a full segment on this later, but I'm very encouraged by the many ways in which the scattered tribes of home automation finally seem headed to unity. One thing that rocked their boats is the explosion in personal assistants like Google Home and Alexa. And these made all those little gizmos on Zigbee or Z-Wave or whatever need to shift into a we support that accessory mode. It's like a lot of performers who all thought they were destined to be starring in their own series now resigned to the role of an occasional walk-on bit part, making home automation a lot like the Love Boat. But Amazon and Google and Apple announced they are working together toward interoperability. Microsoft didn't say anything, but I think they want Cortana to play nicely too. As for Samsung, well, I'd rather they just let Bixby die. And that's just part of the story. There's a company in the Netherlands with a hardware product that can bridge all of those different home automation protocols and at the same time provide them all with a united command structure that makes it easy, as easy to create more refined, more nuanced control programs as it is to work a vending machine. As I said, I'll have more on this later, but it looks like the era of non-intercompatible protocols and all of that tribal segregation, that era can soon end. Oh, and the days when you have to ask a voice assistant to connect you to a device with its own voice controller, well, those days should also be ending soon. I'm also seeing a lot of advancements in small components that can smell things. Sensors for many different kinds of gases, for example, and I think we'll start seeing those in a broad swath of products, from safety devices to help deal with dangerous fumes, to household products that can help keep things smelling fresh without smelling like the candle stores at the mall. Sometimes it's easier to watch marketplace icebergs collide than to guess what the outcome will be. And notebook computers, it's easy to see that they're either getting gutted to put compromised performance out at a really cheap price tag, or they're getting gut-wrenching price tags. How will users respond? LED light bulbs are starting to approach what the industry calls socket saturation, meaning you've put bulbs that last 5 to 25 years into the sockets. When are you going to have to change them? What are they going to sell next? Those bulbs won't need changing soon. What's in store for that category? Almost any personal computer in use today has its own battery. It's mostly notebooks, isn't it? Will that mean disaster for the companies making low-end UPS backup power products? Finally, let's talk TV. Everyone who's ever signed up for a cable or satellite TV service knows the pitch. They'll package the basic channels and whatever clusters of premium channels you want to add. You want to add those on, fine. You'll have the convenience of everything you want to watch, all reaching you through their set-top box, and they'll be the only people you have to pay for all that. Well, not anymore. It's original programming that makes it attractive to add Netflix or Amazon Prime or CBS All Access or Disney Plus or any of the dozens of other choices, each with its own monthly or annual fee. And those can add up quickly. Now, we don't know of any set-top boxes that can always offer all of them, but we do know that TiVo offers a lot of them, and we'll guess that they have something else up their sleeve. Probably aren't not able to talk about it until the merger or acquisition or whatever it was goes through. You know, boxes aren't the only route. A lot more TVs are internet connected, able to tune to those premium content streams and also able to take updates over the wire to keep expanding that selection. But they can be confusing to some people. Still, cable and satellite aren't offering as much truly 4K content as some of the streaming services. It will take upgrades to their physical plants and distribution build-out and equipment before they'll be ready for that. It's almost better for them to stream 4K channels over internet connections. Short-term, though, there's unlikely to be any one single thing that can tune everything. But that begs another question. Let's suppose you had a box that could get a few hundred cable channels in 4K and a few dozen of the premium streaming services. Who exactly is it who can afford both the cost of all that content and the time to watch it all? Arguably, it's somebody who doesn't need to work for a living. Next time, two developments promise to accomplish something that stymied the growth of home automation for more than a decade. As I've said, it's desegregation, not among races of people, but among the separate protocols and brands that represent the separate and non-interoperable tribal landscape of home automation until now. Several huge companies are the champions of one corner of this turf, but a small company from the Netherlands is surprising us with their ability to tear down those walls. Join me next time and learn how all those very different home automation pieces can join and reason together.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Lightning Talks, Thursday, January 9th, 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 208 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, January the 10th, 7 p.m., and they meet at the Old Westbury campus of the New York Institute of Technology, Harry J. Scherr Hall in Westbury, New York. The Kingsbyte Computer Club meets Tuesday, January the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on current trends in personal technology. Thursday, January the 23rd, 6:45 p.m. is the meeting time, and they meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on how to smartify your home. Thursday, February the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams New York Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, they meet on Friday, February the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. And a heads up, Trenton Computer Festival 2020, Saturday, March the 21st, at the College of New Jersey in Ewing, New Jersey. This year's conference theme is Artificial Intelligence. For more information, you can go to the website tcf-nj.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, Benjamin Rockwell, and Mark Leosa, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.